Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Monday afternoon edition of Cover to Cover. I'm your host most Mondays, Denny Smithson, and I'm delighted to have once again at these microphones this afternoon on Cover to Cover a woman who writes books like nobody else I know. Antonia Juhas has written a new book about big oil. It's called The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. I interviewed her back in May of 2006 when her last big book came out, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. She's a fellow with Oil Change International, which makes me think of oil changers. Would you change my oil, Antonia? Okay. And with the Institute for Policy Studies. She's served as an aide to two U.S. members of Congress. We'll find out who. And holds a master's degree in public policy from Georgetown University. Award-winning writer and frequent media commentator, her work has been featured in dozens of publications, including the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, the L.A. Times. She's appeared on Marketplace on NPR and Washington Journal, also with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, among many other radio shows. And she lives right here in San Francisco. An amazingly big book with lots of facts that make you wonder how in the world she got them. Persistence, hard work.
Reading.
And a lot of people out there who were as concerned as you and who were able to help you gather information. About the perfidy of big oil.
And I would say most importantly, in addition to the long, hard hours, and this really was far more than a full-time commitment for the last 2 years in getting this done, because it was very important to me that it get done before the elections. And I've been on the road basically nonstop since the book came out October 7th, literally nonstop since the book came out, just really trying to get the message of the political power of the oil industry out prior to this election. And my time and commitment, of course, was huge, but I also had the immense benefit of two incredibly fine research assistants, Sam Edmondson and Kellick Stevenson, who helped tremendously. And then I also had, as you see throughout the book, it's really heavily utilizes interviews with people, from the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust for the state of California to activists in Richmond, to policy wonks, to journalists, to everybody in between. I really was able to spend a lot of time talking to people, and people were very generous with their time. And then I relied on lawsuits, congressional investigations, tax returns, lots and lots of time digging through corporate tax returns, the fine work of other investigative journalists, reading every book out there, and was really, I think, able to put together a truly comprehensive analysis of this industry.
You must have connections in Washington also. That I said, we mentioned them. You worked as an aide to two U.S. members of Congress. What were you doing and who were they?
Yeah, I worked first for Congressman John Conyers and then for Congressman Elijah Cummings. And when I entered working for Congressman Conyers, it was after graduate school, which I also focused on policy in graduate school. And after I had worked for many, many years with a group called Wider Opportunities for Women, where my focus was poverty, alternative poverty measurements, ways of using government policy to address economic inequality. So my focus in working for Congressman Conyers was your basic domestic social policy, AFDC, back in the day when there was such a thing, job training, child care, social security, welfare, what I meant to say was Medicare, those nuts and bolts of economic policy. And it was in doing that work that I just kept, how shall I put this, butting my head against the power of multinational corporations and their ability to stymie the most basic, what seemed to me the most basic domestic policy work. And it really shifted my focus to change my economic analysis from a domestic one to a more international focused one. And when I went back to work for Congress the second time, I was focused on international trade and finance policy, and after that went to work for 5 years at the International Forum on Globalization, which many of your listeners, I'm sure, are very familiar with.
Yeah. We're talking with Antonia Juhas. The name of the book is The Tyranny of Oil, just published by William Morrow. You know, you would think we learned something from history. We went through this back in the early 20th century with Standard Oil and broke it up. There were movements that emerged that were powerful enough to take it on and actually beat it back down and make it into smaller companies and so on and so forth. What happened?
Mm-hmm.
Why in the world would they want to do what they somehow have managed to do, which is to get, conglomerated again?
Merge back together again. The book starts with the Standard Oil chapter. You know, obviously for important historical reasons, that's where all the companies come from. Standard Oil, the largest oil company, largest corporation in the world at its time. But I also start there because it's a hopeful chapter for me. It's the story of successful organizing, remarkably similar to where we are right now in terms of the economy. I mean, if you listen to the speeches, especially in these winding moments of the election, of Governor Palin, Senator McCain, of course, Obama, and maybe to a lesser extent Biden, everybody is a populist today. Everybody's talking like a populist. And that's because our economy is in such a remarkably similar moment to where we were in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, when Standard Oil and other corporations were at their economic pinnacle, and people around the country were angry, not because of prices, not because of monopoly control vis-a-vis prices, although that was important, but primarily because of monopoly control vis-a-vis the government. People were pissed off that corporations...
Can't say that on the radio.
Excuse me. People were very annoyed, upset, disheartened. sorry. That corporations were... controlling government decision making, and most importantly, the government was unable to regulate corporate activity on behalf of the public good. So people organized in the populist movements, in the progressive movements, in revolutionary movements, and succeeded through very hard work in implemented. And while some sought revolution, what they got was regulation, the very first regulations on corporate activity in U.S. history. The 8-hour workday, the 40-hour work week, the first campaign finance laws in the United States, and antitrust law, the target of which was Standard Oil, the focus of which was that corporations should not be allowed to get so big in the United States that they make it impossible for the government to regulate them. So the people succeeded, and in 1911, the Supreme Court broke up Standard Oil into 34 separate corporate pieces. And that was a tremendous victory among many other tremendous victories. So it took about 100 years, and what I trace in the book is that 100-year process in a lot of realms, but one particularly important now is what happened to antitrust law in the United States. And I had the fortune of interviewing the last four heads of the Federal Trade Commission, the government body that's supposed to implement antitrust law, beginning with Michael Perchuk, Carter's FTC chairman, and moving into today, to look at what happened. And what happened was mostly, to put two words on it, Ronald Reagan is what happened, and a complete abandonment of antitrust policy in the United States, which then opened the door to the mass mergers that we've seen since.
Like the merging of big oil and the government with the Bush administration.
Yeah, like that merger. That's a very big merger. But in addition, the mergers of Exxon and Mobil, of course, Chevron, which, you know, for those of us who focus on Chevron locally, very important to realize that Chevron is the product of a mass merger, which is Chevron first purchased Gulf Oil, an enormous oil company, in 1984. It then purchased Texaco. It then purchased Unocal. Texaco had already purchased Getty Oil, another enormous oil company in its own right. And that all of that is now embodied and more in Chevron. There's also Conoco and Phillips were allowed to merge. BP was allowed to buy Amoco and Arco. Shell bought many other pieces. And then these companies massed into today, the largest economic force in terms of their profits on the planet. There is no other comparison at all.
Let's talk a bit about those profits and how they've managed to find a way to get around everybody and regulate the actual prices. If you would, please, in a word, explain the deregulated futures market.
In a word.
And how big oil has used it to set prices and do an end run around OPEC countries and so forth, who used to set the prices. futures market, isn't that some kind of gambling? I mean, of course, the whole stock market is, but can you sort of try to figure that out for me?
Sure, and just to emphasize the importance of this key piece of this discussion, one of the things that Senator Barack Obama has pledged to do upon election, and I certainly hope that he gets elected, and this is something we have to hold him to, among many other things, is to close this deregulatory loophole that I'm about to describe right now. And we have to make sure that he does this. It's called the Enron loophole. And in 2000, the oil and gas industry spent more money than it had ever spent until this year on any presidential election getting Bush and Cheney into office. After they succeeded in getting Bush and Cheney, I would say, appointed to the presidency and vice presidency in the lame duck session of Congress that followed, the 2 months before they came into office, the banks, the oil companies, and Enron joined together to lobby the government. Phil Graham was their target to deregulate a bunch of derivatives trading. They were successful. Graham slipped into an 1,100-page omnibus appropriation bill, this little piece of legislation called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. We owe the subprime mortgage crisis in many ways to this act. We also owe high oil prices in many ways to this act. And what it did was just got the government out of the job of regulating a whole bunch of things that traders did. And one of those things was energy trades, key energy trades. The first casualty was the California energy crisis, which folks can read about in my book, thanks to Enron. The second casualty was the price of oil. And how this was accomplished was through the deregulation, BP, Shell, Total, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley were allowed to set up their very own exchange in Atlanta on which crude oil futures could be traded. And that exchange was completely unregulated, is completely unregulated by the U.S. government. It's called the Intercontinental Exchange. Now, we live in a very unique moment in history. From about World War I to the mid-70s, the oil companies owned the world's oil and set the price of oil. They owned the majority of the world's oil so they could set the price. Then from about the mid-70s till about the mid-1980s, the OPEC nations owned the majority of the world's oil, and they set the price for oil. Today, nobody owns a majority. Nobody has the capacity to unilaterally set price. That function has been taken over. First, it was taken over by markets, I would say, in a fairly, in a way that most people would feel okay about. But then this mass deregulation took place, and futures trading moved more and more and more aggressively onto exchanges. But most importantly, in 2006 was the moment when the price of oil hit its massive skyrocket up, the big shift up. 2006 is the moment where more crude oil futures trades were taking place on the deregulated Intercontinental Exchange, ICE, than were taking place on the regulated New York Mercantile Exchange. More and more and more trades were happening. The futures exchange became the price setter for oil because of so many trades, and all of the trades were deregulated, and that created its own demand, and more traders came in, and the price went up and up and up and up. But a word on who these traders are. These traders, after Enron imploded, Enron's energy traders went to work at Chevron, at BP, at Goldman Sachs, at Morgan Stanley, at the oil companies, and at the banks, and in their own hedge funds, trading in crude oil futures, doing the exact same thing with crude that they were doing with electricity in our state. I would argue manipulating price, sending the price up, 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 and up, and making it possible for the oil companies and the banks to reap these gargantuan profits. Because those two investment banks that I keep naming, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, those should ring in people's ears because they're the only investment bank still standing. The reason why they're still standing is because they have morphed into oil companies. They own oil fields, they own oil tankers, they own pipelines, and they own the exchange on which crude oil is now being traded.
Futures are guesses about what the price of oil is going to be?
Yeah, a futures contract is quite literally a promise to deliver a good in the future at a price set today.
I see.
However, no goods trade actually physically change hands on future exchanges. It's all about money. physical oil changes hands through private contracts of which we know nothing about between Exxon and Japan, between Chevron and Iraq. These are private contracts. We know nothing about them. That's how the physical oil moves. Physical oil also moves on the spot market, but money moves on crude futures markets, on all futures markets. And it is the massive amounts of trading taking place, unregulated trading on these markets, that led to the skyrocketing price of crude.
These words of wisdom are being spoken by Antonia Juhas. The name of her book is The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, published by William Morrow. Antonia is going to appear a number of places, and the nearest appearance will be in San Francisco on Wednesday, November the 5th. She'll be appearing with Rebecca Solnit, Guy Fawkes, Michael Schwartz, at 7 o'clock at the new Green Arcade bookstore on Market Street. We haven't got an address, but Green Arcade is the name of the store, and it's actually reopened recently, and a former colleague of mine at Cody's Books is the owner and manager of that new store. So I'm happy for Patrick. That's, again, 7 o'clock on Wednesday evening of this week at the Green Arcade Bookstore. A little bit later on, she's going to be appearing in early December on the 4th in Arcata at Northtown Books. She'll be appearing in Mendocino on the 5th of December at Gallery Bookshop, and again in December on December the 10th in Sonoma at Reader's Books. So those are all over a month away, or at least a month away. Well, you wonder how far oil will go to protect themselves, to control supply. We obviously know they'll go to war to do it. Mm-hmm. They went to war in Iraq, in spite of the fact that I still see occasional, you know, talking heads on television saying, oil? It wasn't about oil? Or you must be kidding. You know, that's old news. It just drives me crazy the way doublespeak, you know, and all that stuff is happening. And that's, of course, part of the game they play. With oil men and women in control of the administration, from Condoleezza Rice on up to George Bush, obviously the door was opened and the war was begun because these folks really wanted to control the Middle East and the oil supplies in that part of the world. Do you think that when this war is over, whenever that will be, that the Iraqis are going to control their own supply, or are they going to give in?
Let me just say two things. The first is, I think one of the best contributions that I made in this book was in the war chapter, and it was really my most comprehensive analysis of the role of U.S. oil companies and BP and Shell in the decision to go to war, and in most importantly, laying out what winning the war would look like. How do you win a war for oil? What does that look like on paper? And what that looks like on paper is this long attempt that they've been trying, the oil companies with the Bush administration, to get the Iraqis to implement the Iraq oil law, which would change Iraq from a nationalized oil system into a privatized system. That has thus far been unsuccessful, even though just 3 days ago, President Bush was meeting with Barzani, the Kurdish president and vice president of the larger Iraqi government, trying to get the Kurds on board with the oil law. They are meeting right now as we speak, trying to get the oil law passed as part of the larger security promise, larger security agreement. The oil companies and the Bush administration, believe me, have not given up. What has stopped the oil law from being passed, and I also tell this story, is a remarkable story of resistance, which is, you know, the Iraqis learned of the true nature of the law. I truly believe that if this law had been able to be moved in stealth, it would have happened long ago. Mm-hmm. But Iraqis learned of the law, European activists, American activists, American policymakers, American elected officials, European elected officials, very upset at the idea that the war would be used to secure oil, to privatize the oil against the will of the Iraqis, all joined forces, and through consistent resistance. And in Iraq, what I'm talking about in terms of resistance are, you know, traditional street protests, sit-ins, you know, writing to their elected officials, writing to American officials, public hearings, raising awareness about this law, opposition to the law, protest against the law, those protests being mirrored in the United States, in Europe, keeping a firm, bright spotlight on this law internationally, what it is really intended to do, who it would help and who it would hurt. And thus far, it is resistance in the Iraqi parliament that has stopped this from happening. And that is an amazing, amazing feat and needs to continue to be supported and needs to continue to be watched, because it's certainly the agenda of the goal of this war. And, you know, this, and this war is not the end of the story. So in the, you know, the whole chapter, I talk about the spread of the military under the Bush administration along oil, where oil's found in oil transit routes. All, you know, the largest buildup in the U.S. military abroad since the Cold War, all of which is going to have to be undone by the next administration. I mean, for example, the Bush administration just launched AFRICOM, the new U.S. centralized military command structure for Africa, essentially doing to Africa what we have done for the Middle East, providing a military structure, I would argue, principally to ensure a steady flow of oil. And the next administration is going to have to tackle the fact that AFRICOM is now official and it's been set up, and I would say roll that back. And there's a lot that's going to need to be rolled back, which I tried to articulate through this chapter.
I hope you voters who haven't gone out yet are listening. I doubt if there's anybody listening to this right now that hasn't already made up their mind about who they're going to vote for. But there's just no doubt in your mind, I take it, that there's a big difference between what the two candidates would do regarding big oil.
Yeah, I mean, the two leading candidates, you know, in this race, there's obviously an enormous difference. And I'm not speaking for the organizations I represent, but personally, I'm a huge Barack Obama supporter. That said, we as progressives have a big job set out for us, regardless of who wins. But what we have to be very clear about, when and hopefully if Barack Obama wins, are the very clear demands that we are going to make of him and his administration, and how we are going to, as a movement, continue to organize to make sure that those demands are met.
Mm. We have to touch on the environment, environmental aspect of all of this before we run out of time here in just a very few minutes. It's sad when I see these Chevron ads that make us try to make us believe that that they're out there doing their greenest, mm-hmm. you know, to make things better, and they're using less energy and so on and so forth. It really is doublespeak, isn't it? I mean, they put very little money into these projects, the ones that would really matter.
Yeah, I worked very, very hard to try and find out from all of the oil companies exactly how much they spend on green energy alternatives. And what I ended up doing was really toiling through their tax returns, and was able to put numbers fairly successfully on how much they spent on green alternatives. And for Chevron, in 2006 and 2007, the totals were about 3.8% and 2.4% of total expenditures. Now, that's real money. But when you look at their advertisements, and their advertisements show us in their three-bar logo that try and convince us that they are equal parts, you know, wind, solar, hydrogen, geothermal, oil, that's absolutely not remotely the case. They're, I would argue that, you know, in terms of the rest of their investments and what they're investing in, which is tar sand production, shale production, offshore production, the most environmentally destructive modes of oil production we have yet to come up with, when they're facing the lawsuits they're facing by Nigerians alleging mass, gross human rights abuses and murder for oil production, Ecuadorians alleging mass environmental and human health abuse in their country, Richmond residents alleging outright deception and lies in terms of environmental impact statements at the Richmond refinery. For Chevron to try and frame itself as this green, healthy company, you know, it just does not stack up with the financial evidence or any other evidence that I was able to come up with.
Yeah. The book does give a good overview of our local battle here with Richmond, in Richmond, rather, with Chevron. Well, the solution, as you put it, the separation of oil and state. You want to break up big oil. The question is how and what lengths will they go to stop it. And I'm even wondering, have you been concerned about your work and the enemies out there that really don't like what you're doing?
Oh, no. You know, I think the public is very, very eager and interested in hearing this message. And, you know, that's the only audience that I'm concerned mm-hmm. about, mm-hmm. Those that are interested in hearing it and using it in their work. And I talk about breaking up the oil industry. I talk about getting oil money out of elections to the greatest extent possible. I ask for individuals to pledge to vote for the least oily candidate out there. It's part of Oil Change International's campaign, the separation of oil and state. And I ask for the government to reintroduce its role as regulator of this industry, eliminate subsidies, eliminate tax breaks, introduce regulation at the refinery level, at the production level, really begin to at the gas station level, really begin to take. I believe that we should have high gas prices, high oil prices, but we need to make it possible for people to make this transition. So use resources to invest in a mass public works project for public transit, clean, green alternative energy. You know, I propose a lot of alternatives that I think, you know, the sort of main missing lever is getting the oil industry's influence out of our policy making decisions,
which means cutting off money between big oil and government.
It means getting candidates to renounce money from the oil industry, so that we can be sure that pledges made during campaigns actually become political reality. I'm hoping that in the next day and a half, we can convince the Obama campaign to renounce the $500,000 it's taken from the oil and gas industry, because it sure doesn't need it. And I've given up on the $2 million that McCain and Palin have taken, given that that's the largest amount the oil industry has ever given to a presidential ticket ever. And then for us, as I say, to pledge individually to always vote for the least oily candidate.
Antonia Juhasz, thank you so much for coming in today to talk about your book, The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, published by William Morrow. Again, a reminder, she's appearing Wednesday evening, this coming Wednesday, November the 5th, at 7 o'clock in San Francisco at the Green Arcade Bookstore on Market Street or on Kearney or somewhere right
over
there.
It's on Market, and all of the details are on my website as well, which is tyrannyofoil.org. And I apologize for not having the exact address. It's on Market. I think it's near Goff.
Okay.
And it's a great, great, great new
Goff.
Store.
Not Kearney, Goff. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. I've enjoyed talking with you, and it's a slimy subject, but somebody has to do it.
Thank you.
And with that, let me now let people know a couple of quick things before we tune out of here. First of all, you should tune in Cover to Cover tomorrow at 3 o'clock for Mind Over Media with Jennifer Stone. Next Monday on this show, with a real post-election change of pace, my guest will be local author Donna George Story, who has a Ph.D. in Japanese literature and has taught English in Japan and Japanese at Stanford and UC Berkeley. She's published over 80 literary and erotic stories and essays, and she'll talk with us about her first novel titled Amorous Woman. It gives us Westerners a humorous and intimate view of Japan that few ever see. Donna George Story, Amorous Woman, next Monday at 3. Stay tuned now for the Free Speech Radio News at 3:30, followed at 4 by Hard Knock Radio. I'm your Monday cover-to-cover host, Jenny Smithson. Thanks for listening today, and please, if you can, make the time this week to read or listen to a good book. It's about 3:29.
Looking for something fun to do to kick off your Thanksgiving holiday? How about stepping out with the Berkeley Broadway Singers? Their wheelchair-accessible benefit fall concerts under the direction of Ellen Robinson will take place on Saturday, November 22nd at 8 p.m. at St. Ambrose in Berkeley, and Sunday, November 23rd at 4 p.m. at St. Augustine's in Oakland. For more information about stepping out with the Berkeley Broadway Singers, call 510-604-5732. Or log on to berkeleybroadwaysingers.org.
Stepping out with my baby. Can't go wrong, cause I'm in right. It's for sure, not for maybe, that I'm all
just a